I'm going to be reading from Exodus 20, starting at verse 1 and going on to verse 17. And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth below or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servants, nor your animals, nor any foreigners residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the seas and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honour your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbour. You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, or his male or female servants, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbour. On August the 28th, 1963, 250,000 people gathered in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. They'd come from all over America, and they were mainly there to support the civil rights movement, which had gathered pace over the last few years. Many of them who were gathered there that day had already experienced struggles and hardships. They'd been involved in bus boycotts and sit-ins and marches and various other things. And they'd happened all over America. But on this specific day, on August the 28th, 1963, they'd all gathered together for one purpose: to make known to the government and to the world what was going on, what the civil rights movement was about. And although many things happened on that day at Lincoln Memorial, there were speeches and there were letters read out from people in prison and there were some songs sung by Bob Dylan and there were various other things, people had really gathered to hear one person speak, one person give their address. That person was described as the moral leader of the nation. And his name, of course, was Martin Luther King Jr. And as the day went on and as people gathered, there became an air of expectation and excitement. There were over 400 cameras that had been brought in for the TV channels to record what was going on, all set up at different angles to get the vastness of the crowd and the excitement and the close-up of the speakers, so that this particular speech could be broadcast live around the world. And Martin Luther King stood up and he gave a 16-minute speech, which is fairly unusual for a Baptist minister, I believe. And as he began, people were thinking, what is he going to say? There's this huge gathering, there's this wonderful moment, there's this historic thing that's happening. What is he going to say? What wonderful words are going to come out of his mouth? And of course, towards the end of his 16-minute speech, he came out with the famous monologue that has been entitled, I Have a Dream. It's a speech that would be remembered from that day right until the present day, one that was very influential, one that America grabbed onto. Thousands had gathered specifically to hear this person, and they'd been excited and they'd wondered what he was going to say, and they weren't disappointed one bit. And you know, here, as we come to the conclusion of our, when we're looking through this book in Exodus chapter 20, in a strange kind of way, we get a feeling that actually there are great similarities here between this and August the 28th, 1963. Because you see, here in Exodus 20, we have the people of God. The people of God led by Moses. And they've already been through a lot. You know, since their 400 years of slavery, they have already been rescued by God. They have already seen the downfall of Egypt. They have already eaten manna and quail in the wilderness. They've already battled against the Amalekite army. They've already struggled to understand who they are. They've already grumbled and moaned a fair bit throughout the wilderness. They've already done many things as the people of God. But now they reach a new chapter in their history. Now they reach an important moment in time. They reach Mount Sinai, the place where they are going to encounter God, the place where for the first time God is going to speak directly to his nation. And you know, it's not like he hasn't met his nation before. You know, we've talked about how he's been in the pillar of cloud, he's been in the pillar of fire, he's performed miracles, he's defeated enemies, he's spoken to them through Moses and Aaron and Jethro. He's done many things where he's encountered the people of God. But here, at the foot of Mount Sinai, God will speak directly to his people en masse as they gather. This will be the moment when they glimpse their real future. This will be the moment when they see the dreams of God. This will be the moment when their destiny will become absolutely clear. This will be the moment that they will remember in the wilderness. The moment when God himself speaks directly to his people without Moses translating it all. And you can imagine the excitement in a way, can't you? You know, what would he say? What amazing words will come out of his mouth? What pictures would he paint for them? How would he address them? What would they do? What would he want them to do? How was he going to feel like to be spoken to directly by God? And so with all this in mind, all these questions, the people of God set up camp in front of the mountain. They are consecrated by Moses. They are made ready for this special occasion. And they are told to prepare themselves for the third day. The third day when Moses would lead the people out of camp to meet with God. The third day when thunder and lightning and thick cloud would descend on the mountain. The third day when a loud trumpet blast would be heard for all around. The third day when smoke would billow up from the mountain as if it was a furnace. The third day when the whole mountain would tremble and when the trumpets would grow louder and louder and louder and the people would gather. And so they stand there, trembling. They're fairly frightened, I can understand why. And they're ready to hear the words of their leader, ready to finally hear the unadulterated words of their God directly from his mouth. And so after a short interlude, where Moses goes to speak with God, maybe a few Bob Dylan songs, I don't know, you never know, God finally speaks to his people, and they are gripped, What was their moral leader, their God, going to say? Well, he says 10 things. 10 things at this memorable moment, which when shortened, sounded like this. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Honour your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony. You shall not covet. When God finally speaks directly to his people, he says 10 things. 10 things which would become the bedrock of Jewish society. 10 things which the people of God would keep central to their laws from now on. 10 things which the Pharisees would pick up on and expand upon in years to come. 10 things which Jesus would refer back to time and time again. 10 things which would make their way into many laws in many lands today. 10 things which would be etched in stone and etched in history. 10 things which primarily began with the words, "You shall not." At the foot of Mount Sinai, God speaks 10 rules, 10 stipulations, the 10 commandments. And you know, to be completely honest, it strikes me as a little bit odd. You know, I mean, here we have the whole nation of Israel gathered. We have smoke, we have fire, we have trumpets, we have trembling, we have a huge big build-up. And then God lists off 8 things that he doesn't want people to do and 2 things that he wants them to do. I mean, you know, the Ten Commandments speech or the I Have a Dream speech. Which one would you rather hear? Which one would motivate you? Which one would drive you? Which one would excite you? Which one would you think was appropriate at a momentous point in history? Ten Commandments, which seem to bring restrictions to life, or a vision of what a free life could be? Seems a little odd to me that God would say these words at this time. I wonder why. I wonder why he chose this momentous occasion to give 10 commandments. Well, I guess to fully understand, we'll need to look at the wider context at which these words came out of. Because you see, as we've said, here at the foot of Mount Sinai were the people of God. But they hadn't just become the people of God. You know, they hadn't just been created for this moment in time. They'd been the people of God for quite a number of years now, for quite a long time. Whether they'd been the people of God all together in one place, or whether they'd been here, there and everywhere, they'd been the people of God for quite a long time. And during that time, they'd known many things. They'd known prosperity, they'd known hardship, they'd known freedom, and they'd known, more recently, slavery. They'd had many experiences. But most of all, during all these years of being the people of God, they had known God. They had known the one who now gives them the Ten Commandments. And whether they'd cared or not, sometimes they hadn't, he had been with them every single moment of their lives. And they'd known him. They'd known him as a faithful God. They'd known him as a righteous God. They'd known him as a good God. They'd known him as a God who would never, ever let them down. And more recently, of course, through our Exodus, they'd known him as a God who delivers, as a God who frees, as a God who brings them out of slavery. They had known God. The point is, they'd got a relationship with God before he gave them the Ten Commandments. So when he delivered the Ten Commandments speech to them, it wasn't like Martin Luther King Jr., who was delivering it to a mass crowd of people he probably never even met. It was God talking to his people. It was God interacting with his community, the community that he had created in the first place, the people that he loved, the people that he'd been faithful to for years. As he starts with, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery." He's talking to a people he cares deeply about. And so when he gives the Ten Commandments, it's clear that they're not simply designed to be a set of restrictions. 8 things that you can't do and 2 things that you have to do. It's clear God's not choosing this momentous moment to lay down laws, to draw a line in the sand and say, you can't cross this line, and if you do, there's going to be trouble. Because that wouldn't fit his character. That wouldn't fit the faithful, loving, generous God that the people of Israel had known for a long time. Instead, he's giving them the Ten Commandments to develop them as a people, to enable them to be different, to enable them to be distinctive. He's giving them the Ten Commandments as a framework so that they can really start to live. I mean, look, he says, "I am the Lord your God, the one who cares for you, the one who created you, the one who's faithful to you, the one who delivers you. I am the Lord your God. Don't have any other gods but me. Don't miss out on our relationship by having other gods. Don't miss out on the depth of what we can have by replacing me with something less. You know, I am the Lord your God. Don't make an idol. Don't restrict me. Don't try and form me into something small that doesn't move. Let our relationship live. Let it move. Let it breathe. Let it develop. Let me be who I am so that your life can be better. I am the Lord your God. Don't misuse my name. Don't make people think that I am whom I'm not. Let them know that I am a loving God. Let them know that I am a generous God. Let them know that I am a faithful God. Let them know who I am. Don't present me in a way that's not true. I am the Lord your God. Live in tune with me. Live the way that is best for you. Keep the Sabbath holy. Have a day where you get away from all that is rat race and running. I am the Lord your God. Don't mistreat others. Don't steal, don't kill, don't covet. Don't treat others the way I wouldn't treat you. Let people see our relationship by the way you treat each other. Let people see how valuable life is by how much you care for each other. Let people see how much I value human life by the way you are with each other in your community. I am the Lord your God. These commandments are here so that your life can be full and deep and free the way that I intended it to be. Not restricted, but free. Really free. The Ten Commandments were given, you see, at this moment as a way to enhance the life of the Israelite community. Not restricted. Do you know, it sort of reminds me of when I first watched the film The Wizard of Oz. I don't know whether there's been a new version, but the old one that starts black and white. And I had a bit of a problem with it because, for a start, I'm not really into black and white movies. And I don't really like musicals. So Simon said, oh, let's watch this film. And I'm like, yeah, brilliant. And then it comes on and it's black and white. And I'm like, oh. And then he said, oh, you know, it's got a bit of singing in. And I'm like, oh. Brilliant. So does it got subtitles? Because that would just round off my day, you know. But no, it didn't. So I started watching it. And not too bad, you know, a bit of drama, a bit of a storm. And then Dorothy gets taken over the rainbow. And oh my word, the colour in that film. A bit too bright, but in the day, I'm sure it was like, you know, magnificent. Everything changes. I'm thinking dreary, black and white, dull, and suddenly, amazing yellow brick road. All these little people, all this dancing and singing and sunshine and everything. And I thought to myself, do you know, imagine back in the day when that first came out, and you're sitting there thinking, oh, same old, same old, and suddenly it's in multicolour. Suddenly, it's transformed. Imagine in the day, the first time that was at the cinema, I thought. People must have been amazed at the colours and the depth and the life that suddenly appeared in that movie. It must have been amazing. And you know, this is the moment in Exodus when God does the same thing to the people of Israel. When he takes the black and white lives of the freed Israelites who are just living, and he gives them the tools to live in multicolour. He gives them the Ten Commandments, stipulations to enable them to live a life of depth, stipulations to enable them to live a life of fullness, stipulations to enable them to live a life of freedom, to enable them to really, really live so that they can be so distinctive, so different, so vibrant and so very alive that nations around them would look at them and they would wish that they had just a tiny bit of what Israel had. A glimpse of what was to come. A glimpse of the future. The commandments, you see, were given not to restrict, but so that the people of God might delve into them and extract the richness that they held and live it out in their everyday lives. Trouble is, over the years, the people of God did the opposite. Because instead of delving in and expanding and living the life the commandments pointed to, the people of God restricted them, took them out of the context of the relationship they had with God, and started to interpret them letter for letter, until they brought the commandments down to their most negative and lowest point. Don't worship other gods. Don't make any images of God. Don't blaspheme. Don't work on the Sabbath. Don't mistreat your elders. Don't kill. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't covet possessions. Don't cross this line, or you have sinned. And to make sure that people knew when they'd crossed that line and when they'd sinned, the Pharisees added all sorts of little laws to make it absolutely clear how people's lives should be lived, until the Jewish life became an indistinctive dirge ruled by law, the very thing that God had never intended it to be. And you know, today, although we still have the Ten Commandments, those wonderful stipulations that were designed to shape a new community, and although we also have the stories of the people of God throughout the Bible, the teachings of Jesus, the life that Jesus lived on earth, and the teachings of the apostles, a rich resource, all recorded in this wonderful book here, the Bible, all given in the context of God's relationship with us, all given so that we might shape our lives on Him, a glimpse of the wonderful life that is to come. Although we still have all these wonderful things in this wonderful resource, designed to delve into, to extract the richness so that it might permeate our lives. Although we still have this, the trouble is, it's often easier, and it's altogether more tempting, to be honest, to take what God has given and to simply reduce it to a line in the sand, which we and others are not allowed to cross. A set of rules which restrict and deny the lowest thing the Word of God could possibly be. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't do the other. Until we find, as the people of God, we are not actually living at all. We have simply turned the Christian life into an indistinctive dirge ruled by law. Do you know, it reminds me of a little made-up story that is a bit twee, but, you know, I'll tell it you. I read it in a book. And it's about a man who looked at life one day, a made-up man. And he looked at life and he thought, how should I live? And so he went around and looked at different situations. And he looked at people who had decided to give to charity, to support those in need. And he looked at how people gave and gave and gave. And he looked at how the more they gave, the more there was to give. And how although they gave all that they had, there were still people suffering, still people hurting, still people in pain. And so he looked at that and this man thought, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll give a little, but, you know, what's the point? I'll just give a little bit and separate my life off. And then he looked at relationships and he saw how people gave to relationships, how they loved each other, how they cared for each other, how they had a wonderful time. And then he saw how people got hurt, how people suffered in relationships, how things happened, how it really upset others. And he looked at relationships, he thought, oh, no, I'll just, you know, I'll give so much, but I'm not going to get hurt. I'm not going to enter fully into this. And he shut himself off. And then he looked how people gave their lives to God. And he saw people following God, giving all they had, worshipping Him, giving their lives. And then he looked at the other side and he saw how it was hard, how it was upsetting, how it took a lot. And he thought, I'll worship a little, but I'll just not too much. And then one day this man lived the whole of his life and he died. And he presented himself before God. And he was very proud because he had distinctly set lines in his life and he'd lived how he thought he should. And he stood before God and he said, God, here is my life. And God looked at him and he said, life? What life? What life? You know, a man called Mike Iaconelli, a youth worker in America who died a few years ago, said this. He said, most people believe that following Jesus is all about living right. Most people believe following Jesus is all about living right. Not true. Following Jesus is all about living fully. Following Jesus is all about living fully. This is why God gave the Ten Commandments. This is ultimately why Jesus came to our earth. That's what life's all about when we follow God, living fully. So as the people of God here in this church, let us live out what we have got. Let us live out what we read about. Let us live out what we see of God. Let us delve so deeply into the Word of God. Let us look so earnestly into the character of God. Let us be so different and so vibrant and so distinctive and so very alive that others will come to see the God that we worship and they will long to worship him as well. Let's pray together.